Hello and welcome to the 10 o'clock live podcast. I'm Lauren Laverne and I'll be bringing you the best bits from the live show in audio form each and every week, if you'll have me. This is your chance to have another listen to all the goodness from this week's show as brought to you by me, Charlie Brooker, Jimmy Carr and David Mitchell. This week was our first ever show and we discussed bankers, NHS reform and university funding. It doesn't sound funny, but it was. Shall we listen? Ooh, let's. Over the next 15 weeks is to explain everything that's complicated in the world, speak to everyone important about everything vital, explode the boundaries of human knowledge, and redefine democracy. Easy. So, David, this week you are taking bankers to task over their bonuses, right?
I'll be taking them to task. I'll be banker bashing. I'm going to get them in the bash pit. I'm going to bash them to a lovely sauce and serve them with linguine.
Oh, that sounds exquisite. Charlie, you have got your eye, God help you, on the next president of the United States.
Sarah Palin. Yes, possibly the only...
It's not a panto.
She's the only horseman of the apocalypse you could conceivably maintain an erection while gazing in the eye.
We've forgotten as we mean to go on, that's good news. And Jimmy, an hour of live TV ahead of us. Are you nervous?
I was a little bit nervous earlier about kind of stuttering through lines in the show, but then the King's Speech has been such a massive hit. You sort of feel people would just think that's adorable and give me a BAFTA.
So, let's find out. Listen, you, of course, can find 10 o'clock live in all the usual places online, but hey, you don't need our permission to do that. Just go ahead and fill your boots. Right now, over to this man, Jimmy Carr, to tell us about the week and what's been in it.
Right. Big news. Shadow Chancellor Alan Johnson has just resigned from the Labour front bench amid rumours of an affair. Let's take a look back at his achievements as Shadow Chancellor. Moving on. He was only there 3 months. You know, what could he do? The former postman that rose to become Shadow Chancellor actually wrote his resignation letter before Christmas, but it only just got delivered. Johnson's departure means that now Ed Balls is Shadow Chancellor, so it's Johnson out, Balls in. I don't think they're doing that right. This week, David Cameron announced plans for what he calls a complete modernisation of the NHS. The plan is to modernise it in much the same way as the Australian floods have modernised Brisbane High Street. Under the Tories, the NHS will still offer a world-class service, albeit a third world-class service. Of course, what these reforms are really about is patient choice. You can choose to die cold and alone at home, or if you'd prefer, on a dirty trolley in a hospital corridor. It's up to you. BP has signed a multi-billion pound deal with the Russians to drill for oil. I'll tell you, if BP are serious about their search for oil, why don't they try looking on the backs of seabirds in the Gulf of Mexico? Apple announced this week that their chief executive, Steve Jobs, is taking an indefinite leave of absence on health grounds. His doctors are trying a radical new treatment. They're going to turn him off and then turn him back on again. Now, Iraq. Tony Blair returns to the Chilcot inquiry tomorrow morning because there were gaps in his initial evidence. The main gap, of course, being between the things he said and the things he actually did. Tony Blair won't be asked to place his hand on the Bible before testifying because they don't want to get blood all over their nice new Bible.
By the power.
Meanwhile, in Iraq this week, 13 suspected al-Qaeda terrorists have escaped from a detention centre in Basra dressed as police officers. You know, if they can't behave responsibly, I'm not sure suspected al-Qaeda terrorists should even be allowed a dressing-up box. Yeah, that's right, I said it. News broke this week that in 1997, a special Vatican department advised Catholic bishops in Ireland not to report suspected paedophiles. Well, the Vatican's got a whole department for that. If any other priests are watching, the only bit of good news for you is hell doesn't exist. You know, there are so many paedophiles in the Catholic Church, it's sometimes easy to forget the Pope is a Nazi. On a serious note, we mustn't let this taint the reputation of Catholic priests who aren't paedophiles. They're both livid. Britain's bankers are set to receive annual bonuses that could total over £7 billion. RBS boss Steve Hester is in line for a £2.4 million bonus. If that's difficult to visualise, just imagine the average yearly bonus of a nurse and add £2.4 million and hand that to an undeserving shit. And that is the news this week. David.
Right. Well, bankers. Our anger at the banking sector has gone way beyond irritation at the pens on strings. And today, it got worse. Goldman Sachs announced almost £10 billion of pay and bonuses for its staff, while at the same time cutting their charitable donations by a third. Why can't they keep their pay under control like more reputable firms, such as Nike? So, should bankers be restrained, impoverished and punished? Or should they be set free like a shrew with a broken leg that's tried to destroy the world? With me, our former partner at Goldman Sachs, Richard Sharp. Head of research at the High Pay Commission. That's a commission I'd like to be on. Beats the shit out of the Hard Work Commission. Zoe Gannon. And Tory MP Kwasi Kwarteng. Thank you all for coming. So, Richard Sharp, are payouts like the Goldman Sachs one announced today and the bonuses I've talked about, are they remotely justifiable?
Yeah, they are.
Go on then.
It doesn't mean people like them. Apart from those who receive them, of course.
Right. I think you're right. If more people got them, I'm sure they'd... Well, you know. I'm no expert on economics, but I think that might be inflationary.
Actually, the good news is that Jimmy is receiving some of Stephen Hester's bonus, because we all share in the taxation that goes on the bonuses and taxes the banks.
Right.
And when any banker receives a bonus, about 63% of that goes to the Exchequer. So the question is, would we rather not have that industry, and would we rather pay for those things ourselves rather than have bankers pay for them?
So you're saying the industry is worth having because we get a huge tax take from it, essentially.
Yes,
so
right.
Would you agree with that?
That's an interesting point, Richard. my point of view is this. The UK taxpayer bailed out these banks worth billions of pounds in explicit and implicit backing. And now, while the bankers are getting millions of pounds of bonuses, it's the UK taxpayer who's suffering. You know, they are getting increased VAT, higher inflation, they're getting greater unemployment, they're getting more public sector cuts. You know, this doesn't really strike me as fair. And actually, you know, what the bonuses really show is that the banks are back to business as usual, just as they were before the crisis.
Well, yes, well, Kwasi Kwarteng, what would you say to that?
I'd say that we've got to distinguish the different types of banks. I mean, let's be fair.
The ones that are in business. And
well, some of them...
There are all those solvent banks that were doing absolutely brilliantly.
I think there was my piggy bank. I appreciate that. There is a lot of mileage in banker bashing, and clearly, you know, this is one of the themes of the evening. Yeah. But there were two different types of banks. There were those banks that took the taxpayers' money.
Yeah.
Like RBS and Lloyds. And there were other banks that specifically didn't take.
But they would have collapsed if there would have been, if there was a run on the banks that we saved, there would have been a run on all the banks. Isn't that
that's
right?
I don't think that's true.
Richard Sharp thinks it's right, and he's a banker.
Well, look.
it would be like a domino effect.
There are those banks that were insolvent and those banks that are solvent, but there's no doubt that the system, supported by the taxpayer, provided liquidity when there was a crisis.
That's right. But there was.
So we want our money back.
But there has to be.
Had support from the taxpayer.
No, there has to be a distinction between a bank like RBS, which we own,
Yeah.
And so we are essentially employing him, that Stephen Hester. And a bank like Barclays, which we don't own, but which was bailed out by the...
On RBS, would you say that maybe bonuses should be capped at £2,000? Because I think...
Well, at least that's what David Cameron said before the election. Would you agree with your leader on that?
Massive restraint on the publicly owned banks.
Right.
There's no doubt about that. These people are being funded by the taxpayer directly, and they were bailed out directly. Yes, it is true to say that the government bailed out the system.
Yeah.
But I think the banks that didn't take taxpayers' money, banks that like Barclays that went to the Abu Dhabi royal family and sought other funding.
Yeah.
We laugh,
yeah.
But it wasn't our money that went to that bank.
No, but
and
I
so
think
there is a massive difference.
My point is, it
banks.
Didn't just cost us the money that went to bail out the two banks
That's
that
right.
we put money.
Right.
It cost us lots of other money. It cost the economy over $1 trillion, probably, and we're suffering massive, massive cuts. No, that's not my estimate. I didn't just make up a squillion gazillion.
But what I'm saying is it cost us
a lot of money.
Can I make a point to that?
Yeah, go on.
I mean, you're obviously, you know, guying the audience, and that's very good. But yeah. what I have to point out...
I didn't make them go, ooh. You made them go,
There is a difference. Yeah. Between what we're doing with the deficit,
yeah.
which was because we were spending money that we didn't have, and the bank crisis.
But
there are two very different things.
But Richard Sharpe, I would say that the deficit was caused partly by the recession that was caused by the financial crisis. And you would accept, wouldn't you, Richard Sharpe, that...
You can call me Richard,
thank you. I'm hoping you'll become Lord Sharpe at some point. But would you accept that the other banks would have gone under if we hadn't saved the two we essentially bought, because there would have been, whether they were well-run or not, there would have been a run on the banks.
Absolutely, and obviously Barclays took liquidity from the Fed. The fact is, globally, taxpayers, in some sense, the states around the world supported the banking system because there was a liquidity crisis. So
what should we do to make sure, having bailed them out from their own mistakes,
yes.
what should we do to stop that happening again? Because we can't afford it to happen again. We'll be utterly screwed.
Well, what there will be with the Banking Commission is there's going to be a structural look at the fact that banks shouldn't be in a position that they're too big to fail and behave in a way that causes them to fail.
So you think that the Banking Commission will break up the banks so they won't be too big to fail?
I don't know what they're doing, because they're going to report soon. But what they will do is they'll look at the architecture of banking to ensure that banks can take risks and they live with the risks rather than the citizens live with the risks.
Well, we've got to make...
Unfortunately, we have to wrap it up there. We could discuss that all evening. But thank you very much, all of you, for coming.
Now, following the recent shooting in Arizona, a political blame game erupted in America, and several political figures immediately fingered Sarah Palin. But her critics accused her of encouraging the gunman with her violent rhetoric. Still, it's easy to snipe, especially in America, where you get free bullets with every Happy Meal. Palin accused the left of a blood libel, and this week went on Fox News to movingly pay tribute to the true victim of the Arizona tragedy, herself. But what exactly is a Sarah Palin, and why? Here's a potted guide fronted by a tramp. Who is Sarah Palin? Well, it's a good question, because she sprang from nowhere, or to give it its official name, Alaska. She's not related to nicest man in the world, Michael Palin, unless he accidentally fucked a jackal during a Monty Python tour of North America. Although if he did, he doesn't mention it in his diaries, which is just weird. Hardly anyone had heard of the name Sarah Palin until 2008, when John McCain picked her as his running mate, in a bid to sex up his campaign, which aides were concerned had become impossible to masturbate to. She's anti-abortion, pro-gun, pro-hunting, pro-death penalty. Basically, she leans more to the right than someone who's just had their right leg blown off. Palin is the darling of the Tea Party, a faux grassroots political movement, chiefly consisting of embittered white people too angry to spell check their own brilliant placards. Anyway, now speculation and dread is rife that Palin may be planning to run for president. But could this divisive figure ever really become president? Well, consider her two main qualities. She never backs down, and she's good at pushing buttons. So let's hope not, eh?
Yeah.
Say what you like about Sarah Palin, I still would. Monday was officially the most depressing day of the year. It's cold and miserable in Britain, so maybe it's time to soak up some winter sun at a holiday hotspot. Welcome to Holiday Hotspots. My top tip this week is the jewel of the bit just to the left of the Nile, Tunisia. If you like ignoring Foreign Office safety advice, you'll love Tunisia. It truly is a land of contrast. Some people are fleeing, other people have fled. It's a riot. And if you, like me, are a fan of brand new governments that are identical to old despotic governments, you are in luck, my friend. Tunisia is wonderfully warm at this time of year. It benefits from the balmy Saharan winds and being on fire. It doesn't get much hotter than being on fire. Some need-to-know facts about Tunisia. The flag is a flagpole with a burnt-out flag on top. The national anthem is this. And their main export is Western tourists. Here's a tip. You might want to learn a few handy Tunisian phrases. Phrases like...
هل هذا المبنى اللي يحترق هي السفارة البريطانية؟
Which one of these burning buildings is the British Embassy?
هل يمكن أن توقف التاكسي وتوقف ضربي بهذا هذاك؟
Could you stop dragging me from this taxi and beating me with your shoe? And...
من فضلك, هل يمكن تساعدني يقتل زوجتي؟
Please, can you help me extinguish my wife? What will it cost you? Well, a two-week package deal at the three-star Hotel Tunis for a family of four will cost you £1,200, four pints of blood, and the use of an arm. So there you have it. Tunisia really does have something for everyone, as long as you like fire and rubble. Happy holidays. I don't want to bring anyone down, but the end of the world is nigh. Yeah, that's right, I said it. Birds are dropping from the skies, honeybees are dying, there are earthquakes and floods. Australia is now best described as a sort of floating prison. Someone needs to step up and save the world. Someone with surprisingly good hair for a brilliant academic. Someone like Professor Bjorn Lomborg. Bjorn. Thanks. Thank you for joining us this evening on 10 o'clock live. Now, you're a sceptical environmentalist. You've got some ideas to save the world. Let's not waste any time. Tell us, what are these ideas to save the world?
Well, when we're talking about global warming, you know, we've been trying to solve global warming for 20 years by promising to cut carbon emissions. And right. We've done no such thing. And so we need to start looking at other ways to tackle it. Now, one way is to dramatically increase investment in research and development of green energy. Basically, get it to be cheaper. But there's some other ways that I think you probably find more interesting.
Well, I read the book. I mean, you strike me as you're a bit of a maverick, maybe. I mean, I've heard said you put the mental in environmentalist. What's your plan to save the world?
I put the sensible back into being an environmentalist, because this is really about saying, yeah, that doesn't make sense. But
that doesn't make any sense at all.
No, thank you.
Unless you sound more mental, if anything.
What's your plan to save the world?
If we're not going to reduce carbon, if that's a waste of time, which is a radical thing to say, what should we be doing?
We should be focusing on, for instance, things that can avoid the impacts of temperature rise. You know, we know that, for instance, volcanoes, they lower the temperature of the world simply because they spew up sulfur dioxide in the stratosphere, reflects the sunlight, and actually make the world cooler. Why don't we talk about at least trying to say, would that be one of the ways we could deal with global warming? Give us a couple of decades.
You're saying a way to deal with global warming would be to build a volcano?
No, not build a volcano, but actually emit sulfur dioxide in the stratosphere. This is something that we call geoengineering. It's one of the ways that would be about a thousandth of the cost of what we're talking about, cutting carbon emissions, and it would be implementable today rather than in 50 or 100 years.
Why are you the only person saying this? I've read a lot of environmental stuff over the years. Why are you the only person saying we need to build a James Bond baddie base to cool down the world?
The amazing thing is, I'm not. There are lots of researchers out there looking at the different ways that we can solve this, both looking at how can we make green energy cheaper, look at geoengineering, as we talked about, look at, for instance, most cities around the world are much warmer than their surrounding countrysides because there are lots of black surfaces and very little water and greenery. So add greenery, put more plants in there, and paint the rooftops white. That's actually a way that for 90% of the world's population could make the planet cooler.
So that would be more effective than carbon offsetting?
The point is simply to start talking about Al Gore and everybody else have been saying we should cut carbon emissions for the last 20 years. It hasn't worked. Let's start talking about the ways that we could actually do something that would save the planet.
Okay, so your plan, cool it down with technology, invest
yes.
in research and development.
And, you know, look, we've been trying to make the argument that global warming and many other environmental issues is about telling people, could you please freeze a little more? Could you please not drive your car? That's never going to work. It's not going to work in the developed world, but of course it's not going to work in the poor world, where many people are just coming out of poverty and want to have their own car. The trick is to get technology going so that when people buy their next car, it's not going to be a petrol-guzzling car, but an electric one.
So who else endorses these plans? Who else is on your side?
Well, if you
Other
look,
than
we,
me. I mean, I'm convinced.
And thank you.
I'm pretty gullible, though.
We've asked some of the world's top economists, including three Nobel laureates, to prioritize all the different ways to tackle global warming, to look at where can you get the most bang for the buck. And what they basically said was, get green energy to be cheaper in the long run. That's about investing in research and development. And then look at all these other ways, volcanoes, make clouds whiter, focus on
make
cities.
Make clouds whiter.
Make clouds whiter is one of those...
Did you come up with that idea?
No.
Had you been eating those mushrooms, that had been checked.
No. Look,
it is fascinating stuff. I mean, we've only got a few minutes to talk to you now, but hopefully you'll come back on the show again, because, I mean, it's a very interesting area, and it sounds so positive. Most environmentalists, I find, they've got a very negative view on the, oh, we're doomed. Whereas you're saying, we'll be fine.
Well,
we
no,
just need
no,
to
no.
invent some stuff.
No, I'm saying the only way we're going to solve this problem is by focusing on technology. Look, we didn't solve the world's food problem by telling people, could you please eat a little less? We did so by making the Green Revolution that made food cheaper and more productive.
Okay, well, we've got to wrap up now. You'll have to come back on later in the series. I think I speak on behalf of everyone when I say we'd love to see Bjorn again. Yeah. Professor Bjorn Lomborg. Right, strap yourselves in because it's time to listen to Mitchell.
Jeremy Hunt, the culture secretary, as we call him here on timid, eager to please Channel 4. On Radio 4, of course, they're less respectful and refer to him simply as cunt. That's a dark place. I hear Frankie Boyle was developing a tea time panel show for Radio 4, but gave up because some of the executives' ideas were too twisted. Anyway, it seems Jeremy Hunt, even as his cabinet colleagues hike tuition fees, take a circular saw to public spending, and lure the NHS into a dark alley for a fast, hard, comprehensive reforming, has come up with a delicious spoonful of sugar to help the bulldozer load of excrement go down. He has launched a new channel dedicated to the provision of local news. Well, happy days are here again. Hunt has analysed the media landscape and come to the conclusion that the one sort of television that the British public love above all others, better than quality drama and international sport, the thing they'll make an appointment to view if only the self-serving ratings indifferent liberal media elite would let them, is local news. There's not enough local news, he thinks. Local news is always a brilliant programme and it's hardly ever on. What's on TV, people ask? I expect it's something shit like The Simpsons or The X Factor or Doctor Who. Why, oh, why couldn't it be local news? I'll tell you what I'm doing this weekend. I'm going to get the pizzas in and settle down to a Northwest Tonight marathon. Hunt, Jeremy Hunt said, it is easy to be patronising about hyper-local services. Yes, that's what gave me the idea for this item. People in Barnum, where the hell's Barnum? Isn't that a musical? People in Barnum don't want to watch what's going on in Southampton. People in Chelmsford aren't interested in what's happening in Watford. Yeah, and Jimmy was talking about Tunisia, for God's sake. You're boring all the people in Chelmsford, Jimmy. In 1945, British people were expected to give a shit about what was happening in Auschwitz. That's miles away. How boring for them. You're right, Jeremy Hunt. People only care about things happening right next to them. In fact, we don't need TVs. We can just use windows. Sit by the window watching the local news unfold. 24/7 in high definition and 3D. Instead of a remote control, you can just have a gun. If you get bored by what's on, simply fire the gun at the window and you can be sure that whatever you're watching will change. Hunt's announcement is a meaningless, content-free, upbeat message, like a local news bulletin. Nothing will come of it, and it would be shit if it did.
So listen, here we all are, sitting round a table as if we actually like each other. How weird. Let's talk about some news that's happened. Alan Johnson has resigned amid rumours that his wife has had an affair with his bodyguard. All a little bit Whitney Houston. I mean, how do we feel about this story?
I don't see how it affects his job, unless, you know, she took the calculator.
Jimmy?
It's been a sort of weird day because he resigned and then we didn't quite know what was happening and we thought for ages it might be something tragic that we couldn't make jokes about, and actually it's just a man's life crumbling around him. So that's sort of fine, I think.
It must have been hell for him. I mean, he hasn't enjoyed being Shadow Chancellor, though, has
Apparently
he?
He's not very good at maths. Did he say he wasn't very good at maths?
He doesn't know any of the numbers beyond 7. So he's been having to bluff all this time.
The heartbreak has clearly put him off his maths. Maths doesn't respond well to heartbreak. Poetry, yes.
He's like being Shadow Chancellor, that amazing a job. I mean, you just write. It's like doing maths homework forever. You write budgets that never get used. It's a route to insanity,
It's like being a Lib Dem used to be.
Oh, my goodness. So he's being replaced by Ed Balls, whose wife, Yvette Cooper, is also in the cabinet.
That's his wife, Yvette Cooper.
Well, presumably she doesn't want to be called Yvette Balls. I can't think why. I don't get that.
It seems odd.
It's weird.
It seems odd because that is a funny name.
they're a couple. They get on. Do you think this could potentially be awkward, having a married couple in the cabinet?
Well, they were in the cabinet already. So, you know, now he's just
the
money guy rather than the police guy. So I suppose different sorts of kinky sex.
This week we were talking about the bankers nearly getting away with destroying the economy.
You know what the problem with the bonuses is?
Yeah.
Is that they're just, the money is just, we don't know who these people are and it's just jizzed electronically into their accounts, isn't it? What they should do is they should hand over.
I've never thought about electronic transfers. suddenly you've made online banking so much sexier. Yeah.
What do you think?
Who needs the porn when the banks are jizzing?
They should just hand the bonuses over live on television to them while they stand on their front doorsteps where you can see their address and they live.
It seems odd that everyone's having a go at the bankers for being paid too much, because people don't get paid what they deserve. They get paid as much as they can, generally. And bankers, it strikes me, they get paid as much as they can, which is a tremendous amount. It's sort of like footballers. And people are saying the government haven't done anything about this. And they go, yeah, because the world's not fair.
Ultimately, if we don't want the bankers to earn a lot of money, the government has to do something about it. But people get annoyed at the bankers, bash the bankers, and the government joins in.
We're going to have to write this in an email and send it to Ed Balls to see if he can do it for next time. If he gets in, he can maybe put this as a sponsor. That could work. Okay, let's do that.
If there's one thing that really pisses me off, I call that a good day. At the moment, I'm vexed by the student tuition fees debate. With me to help to get to the root of the issue, hopefully without hurling a fire extinguisher, is the minister responsible for higher education, Conservative Minister David Willetts.
Hi.
Thank you very much. There's some panto noises happening. Politics has never been more vibrant. But thank you very much for coming, David Willetts. Now, under the last Conservative government, higher education was provided for free. And under this current Conservative coalition government, higher education will start to cost students an unprecedented amount. Would you say that that change means that our society is getting better or worse?
When you say it was free, it wasn't
free. It was free to the students.
It was paid for by taxpayers, many of whom earned a lot less than those students will earn after they've graduated. And that's the big question behind all this. Where is the fairness? Who fairly should pay?
So you're saying that the change means it's not paid for by the state, but paid for retrospectively by the students. Well, that is a change for the better.
I'm saying that, of course, students themselves don't pay up front. It's not right to expect the students to pay when they're studying. If after they have studied and they've graduated, they're earning more than £21,000, at that point, they do start paying back the loans that we've provided them with in order them to pay for their higher education. And I do think that asking them to pay back when they're earning more than £21,000 is fairer than saying that people who, you know, if you start paying income tax, if you're earning more than £6,500. So I think it is fair.
So you're saying the previous system, therefore, was unfair?
I think the previous...
When you and I got our higher education for free, that was unfair.
What we did, what we got away with, that is the challenge. What we got away with was a system where people who earned a lot less than we earn paid for us to go to university. And
Should we pay it back?
Well,
I mean, there's
issues about... Well, I hope in our way we do pay it back. I think we all have an obligation to pay it back in different ways. But certainly, when we're trying to finance a system which has got many more people going to university than in my day or yours, David, when you've got many more people going, I don't think you can ask the general taxpayer to pay more and more. It's right to people to pay back, but only, as I say, if they're earning more than £21,000. At the moment, they start paying back if they're earning more than £15,000. So this actually helps the graduates as well.
OK, I understand it. But you say that one of the reasons this has had to come is because more people are going to university. Is that a good thing? Are too many people going to university now? Should it be reduced?
Well,
has it become worthless? Are there now too many graduates in the workforce with degrees that can't really get them jobs?
Well, I mean, some people say that, and of course there are individual courses that are a bad deal, and those, I think, actually, as we get more power in the hands of students, which is really what these reforms are about, I hope those courses will not be ones that students go for. But in general, just to talk the averages, in general, if you're a graduate, you earn over your life £100,000 more than people who weren't graduates.
We don't know whether those averages will play out over the lifetimes in a workforce where 30, 40% have been going to university rather than 10, 15% are doing.
We can't know, but what's interesting is that over the years, when they've been monitoring this, what's happened is the number of people going to university has increased. It looks as if employers' demand for graduates has increased, and so actually the two things have risen in parallel, and it's remained pretty stable, about £100,000 extra earnings over your life if you're a graduate. And that's why, as I say, we're not expecting students to pay, but I think that's why it is reasonable to ask graduates to pay.
But isn't it still the fact that graduates are having to pay, the fact that you think that now you probably will have to pay the money back, does that not make university look like a gamble to people from backgrounds where no one's gone to university before, and suddenly the whole ability university has to enhance social mobility is massively reduced?
Yeah, it would be terrible if they did think that, and I hope that they won't, and I hope we can explain the system properly to them. But of course, when you say a gamble, we've tried to reduce the element of the gamble, because if you're unemployed, if you're in a job that isn't well paid, if you're earning less than £21,000, you don't pay back. So we're providing them with the insurance cover. That's why of every £1,000 we lend, we reckon we'll get £700 back, and £300 we won't collect because people won't be earning enough or they'll be out of work, and it's not right to collect from them. But so that tries to reduce the gamble, innit?
But wouldn't the system be better? Wouldn't there be more of a sort of beacon of social mobility that I think used to be a brilliant thing when we had free higher education? People sort of thought, well, we're a country that believes that if you pass the exams, you should be able to do the course for free as an absolute no-brainer gamble, no gamble sort of thing. Now, don't you think if there was some element of free higher education, maybe you could pass scholarship exams to have free higher education, or take extra exams at university? So if you're a hard-working student, you can get free higher education. It just seems that there's no incentive for people, there's no sign that people can go to university without basically racking up a bill, and, you know, unless they go to university and they don't get a very good job, in which case, why did they go anyway?
But you say social mobility. I mean, the trouble is, of course, that when there were so few people having that opportunity, I'm not sure it was so good for social mobility. I actually think it's great that more people go to university. And you know, these things, I don't think a government should have a plan for it. I think it should emerge from the choices of individuals. But I think, by and large, in advanced Western countries, more people want to go to university.
Okay, and here's my other worry. Your system seems to be that you, as you say, you want students to have the choice. Yeah. And that would create sort of more of a market in university courses, so that the courses that are seen to send people into well-paid jobs will become more popular. Now, I would say that the role of government... But that people are always going to want to do accountancy degrees to become accountants. That, you know, there's money in that. But the role of government would be to encourage and enhance the chances of people who want to go into areas where there aren't necessarily great jobs, but people who want to, you know, study classics or poetry or modern languages, not just the vocational courses. And yet the new government policy seems to just be going along with the market rather than trying to provide what the market doesn't.
Well, the money goes with what the student chooses. And actually, I mean, I agree with your basic point. I want those subjects to be studied. There is more to going to university than what your earnings are afterwards. And if people do subjects that they enjoy and then they're not in a well-paid job, then they won't pay back or they'll pay back less. Right. Of course, part of it is a financial decision, and so part of the conversation we're having is about finance, but there is more to education and certainly more to university than that.
I'm afraid we have to wrap it up there, but I'm glad to hear you say that, and I hope we don't end up with a country, you know, just filled with accountants. But thank you very much, David Willis.
Though we've tried to resist, it's almost as if this table has a little gravitational pull of its own, and we are all here again, talking about news, obviously, and tuition fees. I mean, you know, very interesting interview there, David, and big news. Are university fees about saving money, or is it ideological? What do we think?
Well, I hate the way that they, you know, he seemed like a really nice guy, you know, he seemed perfectly reasonable, but I hate the bullshit of this is an ideological change, it's a great big new idea. Why doesn't he just say, we can't afford any better than this? This is the best we can do. I know it's not good enough, but that's it, that's all we've...
I think we used to be a country where you say if you got into university, you got to go there for free. I think that was a brilliant country that we were. And
you know what? The other thing that I don't quite get is means testing seems to be a very ugly word. People don't seem to want to talk about means testing. It seems to be it's a degrading process. But actually, I think it's slightly less degrading than paying £27,000. And I think people wouldn't mind coming from those backgrounds saying, look, I don't mind being means tested. My parents don't make any money. Pay for my education, you fuckers.
To be fair, it is retrospectively means tested that, you know, if your means subsequently are sufficiently high, you'll pay for your education.
But
I would take it, if I was going to university now, I would take it as a test to sort of see if I can get as educated as possible and then earn as little as possible.
You both completed university. I never went. Charlie, you sort of abandoned university before you got to the end.
Thanks for rubbing that in. Failure.
I didn't go, so I mean, you know, what do you
Sunderland.
Think about this?
No one was expecting.
Screw off, car.
It depends what you get. I mean, £27,000, it's not good value if it's just a bloke shouting three facts about Nelson at you. But if it's a 10
why not?
What if it's a 10-year course to find out what kind of donuts I like? That's pretty good, isn't it?
Okay, well, listen, speaking of that figure Jimmy was bandying around, we asked you with our online poll about the thorny subject of tuition fees. We asked you if you thought a university education was worth £27,000, and 70% of you said no. 30% said yes. Yay! Well
Yay.
Done, yes,
30%.
Lady.
I think she was clapping the maths. Yeah. I think she was just impressed that, oh, that comes to 100. Well done.
I would say it's worth £27,000. If you get into the right job and, you know, it works for you, of course it's worth £27,000. That's a different question to whether you should be charged
£27,000. This is the interesting
thing. You're starving to death. That a loaf of bread is worth £27,000, you know.
It's a very interesting point you made in the debate, though, about the idea of it's all about getting you a job afterwards and doing better in life rather than education for education's sake, which strikes me as a very valuable thing in our society.
Okay. Listen, before we get to the end of the show, let's have a look at tomorrow's headlines.
I saw this. Car insurance up by 34% to pay whiplash cheats. And I saw that and I double took and I think I've hurt myself.
Lots of Alan Johnson. Obviously, this Telegraph Alan Johnson stands down over claims of love affair. I mean, it's all very sad, but maybe it'll work out for them. Maybe it'll turn out to have been just all a big misunderstanding and the bodyguard has just given her a very thorough cavity search.
Yes, absolutely.
Just to make sure it's all okay.
Johnson's.
They're claiming.
Using cavity a special search, yeah, with his cock. No, we don't know that. This is only things that have been printed in newspapers.
Yes. Well, there
this
you go.
Isn't a real newspaper, obviously. And by I mean, it's a piece of card.
It's like.
But also, the Daily Mail stinks.
That sounds rude.
It's like that.
It's like that Kevin Costner film, isn't it? The Postman. Because Alan Johnson was a postman.
He was.
Do you think
there's a free upstairs downstairs DVD, which sounds rude.
Okay, that's all we've got time for tonight. We will see you after a week of your life. Have a wonderful week, and we'll see you later. Good night.
So that was the 10 o'clock live podcast. Make sure you join us next Thursday night, 10 o'clock live on Channel 4. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at 10 o'clock live. And of course, you can watch it all again at channel4.com/10o'clock live. Until next time then, from me, Lauren Laverne, and the rest of them who couldn't be bothered to come and tell you themselves, goodbye.